From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Tensions between Israel and Palestine continued to escalate. According to the New York Times, Israel bombed about 50 targets in airstrikes Tuesday that Hamas called a, quote, serious escalation, closed quote. We have this report from Press TV's Omar Leski.
Renewed Israeli air raids on the Gaza Strip claim the lives of 14 more people and injure 80 others, including children. The Israeli army says it's carried out some 40 airstrikes on the coastal strip today. Several residential buildings were targeted. Mohammed Shaban, a Hamas military commander, is among the fatalities. The health ministry in the Palestinian territories has announced a state of emergency in all its medical facilities. Meanwhile, the president of the Palestinian National Unity Government has called for an end to the Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. Mahmoud Abbas says the international community should intervene to halt Israel's dangerous escalation. He's warned that the recent wave of violence could plunge the whole region into more instability. Meanwhile, Israel has ordered its military to mobilize 40,000 reservists for a possible ground incursion into the Gaza Strip. According to Israeli media, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs says that Tel Aviv is, quote, preparing for a battle against Hamas, which will not end within a few days. Reports say Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also threatened that all options are on the table, including a ground invasion. Earlier, dozens of heavily armored vehicles, including tanks and bulldozers, were lining up on the Gaza border. Hamas has pledged to retaliate in the wake of renewed wave of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. The group is warning that Israel's latest escalation could lead to a third intifada or uprising. Halal Safadi is a correspondent from Gaza. Halal, first of all, tell us about the latest developments. We are hearing that the airstrikes have been continuing.
Since the early hours in the morning, Israel airstrikes have been taking place non-stop, targeting different areas in the blockaded Gaza Strip. There were airstrikes hitting the north, the south, and the middle area, and even Gaza City. Right now, there are still airstrikes and raids. Drones and warplanes are flying at a very low altitude. So basically, the few coming hours are supposed to carry on a lot of or more dangerous explosions and attacks from the Israeli side. We are now at the moment in the main city in the Gaza Strip, and if we compare the amount of people on the streets or the number of people and cars on the streets to the morning, people are more going home and leaving their workplaces and heading home. We cannot find a lot of people walking at the moment in the streets of Gaza, so they're kind of getting more concerned about the next few hours. Israel airstrikes targeted around 16 houses since today morning, two mosques, and a number of empty lands all over the strip. And what's dangerous here when they target the empty lands, as they claim, is that the lands are located next to very populated or very crowded neighborhoods. So they're using huge weapons and rockets targeting those lands and empty lands, which totally affect the entire neighborhood, especially the houses close to or near the empty lands. And this is why the injuries are raising. Now we have over 81 injured, 25 of those are critically injured, and we're talking about a minimum of 11 or 14 people who were killed only today since the morning. So death toll is rising, as well as the injuries. The next few hours are supposed to be very tough on Gaza, but still at the same time, the fighters in Gaza are also launching rockets at Israel as a way of self-defense. Obviously, what's happening in Gaza is not defense, as Israel claim, but it's an offense.
Right, and hello, something else. We're hearing that a ground incursion is a possibility now, and that armored vehicles were lining up across the Gaza border. More than 40,000 reservists also called up. What can you tell us about the border region, what's happening there, and whether Hamas is expecting that ground incursion?
Well, as I said, that the situation is getting more complicated, and it's totally deteriorating, especially if you look at the last few hours. Now, there is 40,000 reservists that are on next to the Gaza borders. We're talking about that. We're talking about ambulance service that are on 3 out of 4 alert. So basically, ambulance services are 75% alerted for what's happening next in Israel. Schools are shut down in Israel, and situation there is getting more complicated. People are going to shelters, as they say. So basically, this shows that this situation is to escalate, and people are kind of expecting a ground invasion, although many political analysts do not think that Israel would go a further step into a ground invasion, as they would be scared of what's coming next, and especially that the fighters and the resistance in Gaza has said that they have rockets that that can reach more than 80 kilometers far into Israel, and they can hit Tel Aviv. So they, so political analysts here do not really think that they will play with the card of an invasion or a ground invasion, but they'd rather stay safe and not lose a lot or not lose a big price in this offensive, and it would be limited to airstrikes and assassinations. And this is very clear if you look at what's happening in the last few hours. Motorcycles were targeted, houses were targeted, and cars were targeted. So basically, they're getting their targets and hitting their targets while they're up in the sky, not on the ground, because maybe they're really scared or they don't dare to go into a ground invasion in Gaza, especially that Gaza is loaded with resistance and weapons that can stand and defend the people of Gaza.
The Arab League has now called for a UN Security Council meeting on the situation in Gaza. Can you confirm then, Hala, for us that today, just to make it clear, 81, you said, have been injured and 14 have been killed only today?
Well, according to Ashraf al-Qadra, the spokesperson of the health ministry, he stated that 81 has been injured and there are 14, there are 11 people who were killed, but there are people who are thought to be killed, but they're still under the ruins, under the ground. So that's why we did not confirm the number of 14. So they mentioned that one was killed in the middle area today morning, three were killed in a car that was targeted, including the naval commander of Al-Qassam. And also seven were killed in an attack, or they targeted a house in Khan Yunis, which is in South Gaza. Seven were killed, and among those there were kids and women. So those are the numbers that were confirmed. Until now, they're saying that there are many bodies under the ground, but still there is no confirmation about this number.
Thank you very much, Hala Safadi, a correspondent from Gaza. Muslim and Arab organizations have held a demonstration in front of the Israeli embassy in the Argentine capital, Buenos Aires, to condemn the atrocities, they say, that have been committed against Palestinians. The protesters called on the international community to take action against Israel over its crimes against humanity. Press TV's Manuel Giffoni has more.
The Palestinian Federation of Argentina and the Argentinian Islamic Organization held a rally outside the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires to condemn Tel Aviv's attacks against Palestinians and to express solidarity with them.
We're here to speak about horror, genocide and torture. Zionists learned a lot from the Nazis, and this must be denounced, because unfortunately more of these atrocities are expected to come from them. This regime must be sanctioned by the international community.
This is not the first time Islamic and social organizations come together in Buenos Aires to call for an end to Israeli atrocities and to urge the international community to recognize the Palestinian state.
Once again, the criminal Israeli regime shows its brutality to the world. Palestinians have gone through every sort of peril one can imagine, and these new actions are unacceptable. They muzzle their own people so the Israeli themselves cannot protest against the horror. We are here to shed light on these crimes.
International human rights organizations that fought the bloody Argentinian dictatorship decades ago say they can't turn a blind eye to the current crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip.
I have lost a son to a dictatorial regime that also took the lives of thousands of people, and I'm outraged by what's going on in Palestine. They're only struggling for freedom and independence like our sons once did. The world must boycott Israel so it stops buying weapons that are used for these atrocities.
This protest is not just against Israel's ungrounded attacks to Palestine, but also against world powers that back this regime in its frequent disrespect to human rights. Demonstrators demand the government to condemn Israeli attacks and to urge Tel Aviv to immediately stop bombing the besieged Gaza Strip. Manuel Giuffoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
The Bahrain government expelled a top U.S. diplomat following his meeting with the main opposition group in the country. According to a report from the Bahrain news agency, the Gulf monarchy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said Monday that it instructed U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Tom Malinowski to immediately leave the country, terming him unwelcome because of alleged interference in the country's internal affairs. The government said Malinowski had been holding meetings with some political groups and excluding others, calling that behavior, quote, contrary to diplomatic norms and relations between states, closed quote. State media quoted the ministry as saying, quote, these activities have included holding meetings with one party, leaving out others who represent different parts of society, which is indicative of an approach which discriminates amongst the people of this one nation, closed quote. An apparent reference to a refusal by Malinowski to allow Bahraini officials to sit in on meetings that he was having with opposition groups. Malinowski was ordered to leave following his meeting with the leading Shia opposition group, Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society. He arrived in the Gulf Kingdom Sunday to strengthen bilateral ties and was scheduled to stay for 3 days. Following the statement, Washington said its diplomat had not left Bahrain. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki spoke about the situation at her daily press conference Tuesday.
L'affaire Malinowski.
Sure. I believe we sent this out, but in case you didn't all see it, I just wanted to give a quick overview of the meetings that he had on the ground. He arrived on July 6th, and that evening he briefly attended the Wefaq Ramadan gathering, which was open to the public. Throughout his visit, he was also scheduled to attend the Ramadan gatherings of a broad spectrum of society, as is traditional. He also met with the Minister of Interior and Police Chief with the National Institution for Human Rights. He had meetings scheduled over the coming days with the Crown Prince, First Deputy Prime Minister and Director General of his office, the Foreign Minister, the Minister of Justice and Islamic Affairs, the Minister of Interior, Ombudsman, the Commission on Prisoner and Detainee Rights, and the Chief of the Public Prosecutor Special Investigative Unit. So as was noted in the statement we sent last night, this was a trip that was prior planned that we'd worked with the government on. He held meetings internally at the embassy today, and he's scheduled to leave today as well. To our knowledge, the government of Bahrain has not changed its position.
How long had he planned to be there?
He had planned to be there about through the end of the week, or through later this week.
And he will leave today, or has let get late there? I don't know.
He's scheduled to leave today. I'm not sure exactly with the time change if he's departed
but
yet.
Will he have had all the meetings that he planned? Or
no, he will not have.
The Bahrainis complained, and you have rejected this, but the Bahrainis complained that he was only meeting with one sector, wasn't meeting with everyone, and that's not conducive to their attempt at dialogue. The Gulf Cooperation Council, the head of that in Saudi Arabia, has expressed the same thing. Are you concerned that this incident is going to affect not just your relations with Bahrain, but also with the broader Gulf, including Saudi, who you've already had a somewhat strained relationship?
We're not. Obviously, we remain and will be in close touch with both the government of Bahrain and any other country that expresses a concern, as would be normal protocol and process. As you mentioned, but it's worth noting, he was scheduled to meet with high-level government officials and had some of those meetings before all of these events happened just yesterday. But no, that's not a concern that we
okay.
have.
Okay. Assistant Secretary Malinowski, in a tweet, which was then retweeted by the State Department, said that this was not about him. This was rather about the Bahraini authorities trying to undermine dialogue and national reconciliation. Is that the position of the administration, of the State Department, that the Bahraini government is not interested in a dialogue and national reconciliation?
Well, we spoke at great length in detail about this yesterday night. Obviously, it's important for all sides, including the government of Bahrain, to move forward on the reconciliation process, but I don't think I'm going to have anything to add to the tweet you referenced.
So did the retweet by the State Department constitute an endorsement of Assistant Secretary Malinowski's stance?
I wouldn't take it that way.
Okay.
Have there been any conversations between the U.S. ambassador and the Bahraini government about something which this building considers highly irregular?
We have been in close touch with the government of Bahrain. I don't have any other specific meetings to detail for you.
How will you respond to this move, to this step?
Well, we're considering our response to the government's decision, but again, obviously this is new yesterday, so I don't have anything to outline
in
that regard.
When can we expect this response?
I can't predict that for you, unfortunately.
When he leaves, is he coming back here, or does he have other stops in the region?
That's a good question. I believe he's coming back to Washington, but we can double-check and make sure that's the case.
He
was scheduled to leave today. I'm not sure with the time change if he's departed yet.
So his last meeting, just so I'm checking, his last meeting was this with this group that they said that it's not desirable to meet them?
Well, he had meetings yesterday also with the Minister of Interior and Police Chief and the National Institution for Human Rights, as well as the WIFAC leaders. But he had meetings with the government as well as obviously members of the opposition.
And if you can clarify, I'm not sure if it's clear or not, the reason that it was the meeting or that they asked for somebody to attend the meeting and you refused to let them in?
Well, he was scheduled. There are a couple of reasons, and we outlined this a bit in our statement, but the government of Bahrain did request to have an MFA representative in all of his private meetings with civil and political society leaders, including inside the U.S. Embassy, and that's not typical, it's not appropriate in our view, and it contravenes international diplomatic norms. But there have been a range of meetings that officials have had within the country where that wasn't requested, so that certainly isn't even consistent with what is standard there.
The statement last night, I believe, said that they demanded, they insisted, it was more than a request, right? Or
well,
did the Interior or foreign ministries have someone present in these meetings, or were they rejected?
Well, not that I'm aware of, Matt. Obviously, there are some meetings where it's appropriate and some where it's inappropriate. I don't have a list of the who was at each of the meetings, but certainly having requiring it or insisting or demanding, whatever you want to use as an adjective, that they be in meetings is something we didn't feel. Sorry, verb. Sorry.
Yes,
caught up here.
There
Go
is
ahead.
Another question related to the same issue. Usually these meetings, I think it's pre-scheduled and pre-arranged
mm-hmm.
and pre-organized with the authorities, whatever they are going. Is that was the case here, or that meeting was like at the last moment was scheduled and then took place?
This is a visit that was highly coordinated with the government. And
with all the details, including the meeting
of
this group?
Well, it's certainly pretty standard. The secretary does, and a range of high-level officials meet with a range of groups, civil society leaders, when they go to almost any country. So it was very highly coordinated with the government.
The reason that I'm asking is that just to be sure that the Bahraini government was aware that the assistant secretary is going to meet this group, right?
Well, I think there was a discussion about his agenda. I don't have the list of exactly the meetings they were aware of, and some of these come together on the ground, but certainly we've had government officials meet with these groups before, so there's a long precedent.
I've heard enough wisdom on this, but how unusual is it to have... how unusual is it to have a host government insist, and that's the language in the statement from last
mm-hmm.
night, that one of its representatives be allowed to attend private meetings that a visiting U.S. official would be carrying out?
Well, it's highly unusual, and in our view, it's also inappropriate and contravenes international diplomatic norms.
So given that Assistant Secretary Malinowski was simply visiting,
mm-hmm.
how does the U.S. respond in this sort of situation? I mean, normally when there's a PNG situation, there's usually a diplomat or two in residence who was then told, pack your bags, you have 48 hours or whatever. How do you respond in something like this to make it clear to the emirate that this is not permissible?
Well, we're considering our response to the government. Obviously, this just happened in the last 24 hours, so I don't have a prediction of the timing or the outcome of that at this point in time.
Is there a concern that the U.S. has to proceed carefully because of the presence of the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain?
Well, certainly our strong relationship with Bahrain is something that we would like to maintain, but obviously we're considering a range of options with that in mind.
Jen,
does the range of options include not maintaining a strong relationship with Bahrain?
No, I don't think I said that it did, Matt.
Well,
but obviously there are Of course, our response, there's a range of options we can consider with that in mind.
Do any of those options have to do with moving the Fifth Fleet?
No, that's not what I said, Matt. I'm not saying that you said it.
I'm asking if...
I was actually trying to convey quite the opposite, that our strong relationship with Bahrain is of course, something that we consider and something we want to maintain, and that's one of the reasons that we're having these conversations through diplomatic channels.
So, in other words, maintaining your strong relationship with the government of Bahrain is equal to or more important than them respecting human rights and working towards national reconciliation?
It's all a factor, Matt. Obviously, we raised human rights issues at every opportunity, and certainly we've expressed our strong concern about the events of the last 24 hours.
Would it be fair to consider the presence of the Fifth Fleet as a bargaining tool or as any sort of leverage?
No, I'm not speculating on that. Obviously, we considering our response. This just happened in the last 24 hours, but I wouldn't go down that that direction, Roz.
So expressing your concern is about... The limit of your language and sort of, expressing this your displeasure with this act. Can't you say that we are, outraged, we are annoyed, we are,
I don't know if you saw our statement last night, but it was a pretty strong statement in terms of our view of the circumstances over the last 24 hours. That remains the case, and we've conveyed that privately, and we'll continue those discussions privately, and we'll continue to consider our response otherwise.
The island nation, situated near the western shores of the Persian Gulf, is home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. It's been gripped by anti-government protests since the beginning of the Arab Spring in February of 2011. The Shia population of Bahrain complains of discrimination and a lack of democracy in the oil-rich kingdom, which has been ruled by the Al Khalifa royal family for decades. The protests have been brutally repressed by police and military force. Hundreds of anti-government activists have been sentenced since the protests began. Saudi Arabia has occupied the country to support the monarchy. As the Obama administration wrangles with Congress, seeking to facilitate the processing and deportation of thousands of children to their native countries, concern has been raised by the UN's refugee agency over the increasing number of asylum seekers who are being deported from countries where they are hoping for refuge. Journalist Patrick Maigwa spoke with the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees spokesperson Adrian Edwards.
What is the procedure that is to be followed when somebody claims asylum?
If you claim asylum, and let's face it, we all have a right to seek asylum. That's a fundamental human right of every one of us. If you're seeking asylum, you have the right to have your case properly heard and assessed. So that is the very important thing that happens, that initially your case is heard and assessed. And if it's confirmed that you need what we call international protection, then you should be entitled to the protection of the state you're in against return to your country.
What situation would necessitate one seeking international protection?
Around the world today, there's more than 50 million people who are forcibly displaced. Amongst those are refugees of about 10 to 15 million, if you include the Palestinian numbers. These are people who are fleeing conflict. They may be also fleeing other types of persecution. That can be political persecution, religious, membership of certain groups, and so on. So there's a number of grounds under which you might be a refugee. But the big problem, the big reason causing so many forcibly displaced people so much, so many asylum seekers in the world today, is conflict. There is a high prevalence of conflict worldwide. That's being reflected in these very high numbers of asylum applications and internally displaced people that we're seeing.
What does the 1951 Refugee Convention state about people who seek asylum?
The 51 Refugee Convention is an international framework designed to ensure that if you have to flee your own country, that there is a form of protection that can apply to you when you're outside your country. And remember that you only become a refugee once you've fled across an international border and have your status as a refugee confirmed through a process. A fundamental principle within that is that you don't force people to go back against their will. If someone has a need for international protection, they should be kept safely or looked after safely or provided with a new life where they are.
And are there any sanctions that can be imposed on states or governments that continually send back people who've claimed asylum?
certainly not in the Refugee Convention. This convention is more aimed at ensuring that you or I or our families and our loved ones, if we have to flee, that there are mechanisms in place under an international law to protect us, to look after us. When it comes to violations of international law, well, then that's something that governments have to account for amongst international opinion.
And where does UNHCR comes when people cross borders and claim asylum? Where does UNHCR come?
Depending which country you're in some countries where you're fleeing conflict, you're considered when you cross a border to have prima facie refugee status. In other words, you're recognised to be a refugee because you and so many others fleeing that place are likely to have a valid claim. In other places, what happens is when you arrive in the country and register your claim for asylum, then you go through a process, which means you have the right to lay out your case, have that listened to, have that be properly assessed, and if you're found to have a valid claim, then to enjoy refugee status and the protections that go with that. UNHCR's role varies from country to country. In some countries, it's the national authorities who do the refugee status determination. In other countries, where that capacity is lacking or the authorities have a wish for us to be involved, that's where we get involved in that process. But also around the world in conflict zones and neighbouring countries, we are there to provide aid for people who are coming across, to make sure that both that people are looked after when they immediately arrive and also to address their urgent needs both then and in the ensuing months and sometimes years. I think one point is worth remembering now is that increasingly the amount of time it takes before we can find solutions for refugees is growing. On average, you may remain a refugee for 17 years. Now, clearly that's an unacceptably high level. We want to find quicker routes to solutions, and we need the support of states for that.
Confronted with a wave of unaccompanied children crossing into the U.S., the White House has nearly doubled its request for funding for increased border patrols, surveillance, deportation, and detention. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest spoke with reporters Tuesday about the president's efforts.
The president is well aware of exactly what's happening on the border. And what we are focused on right now are not political statements that would be made with an appearance, but rather with specific concrete action, steps that can be taken to mitigate this problem.
Photo op, is that what you're suggesting? Is there a downside to him going personally?
No, what I'm suggesting is that the focus of the president's attention is on making sure that we are taking all of the necessary steps to deal with this urgent humanitarian situation. We hope that Congress will also take the steps that are necessary to deal with this emergent humanitarian situation, to give the administration the resources that are necessary to deal with it.
Even though members of Congress and both parties are asking the president to visit those who reside in the border area, mm-hmm. and clearly Governor Perry, I'm sure, will extend an invitation for him to go again. Mm-hmm. Is there a downside for the president being there personally?
For downside for being where personally?
Along the border to see these current situations?
No, I think what is important is it's important for the president to be keenly aware of what exactly is happening on the southwest border and to have a thorough understanding of the impact that the government response to that situation is having. The president has been clear that it's important for us to meet the basic humanitarian needs of these individuals, to ensure that they are given access to the immigration courts in a way that complies with their rights to due process, but also ensuring that we're enforcing the law. The president is regularly briefed on these efforts, and those briefings often are the result of trips made by the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Secretary of the HHS and the FEMA director and other senior administration officials, including some from the White House, who have traveled frequently to the border in recent weeks. I understand that a senior Department of Justice official is scheduled to travel there later this week to also assess the law enforcement situation. So,
does the president want to go himself?
Well, there are lots of administration eyes that are focused on this situation. And the reason for that is that there is an urgent humanitarian situation that needs to be dealt with. And you've seen a very proactive response from the federal government. And what we'd like Congress to do is to act with the same sense of urgency and make sure that this administration has all of the necessary resources to deal with the situation.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.